This is Parking in Bitterman's Circle number 57 for September 14th, 2020. Hi there, it's Aaron. Welcome to Parking in Bitterman's Circle. Today's guest is Will Jennings, a founding member of Bitterman Circle. And, you know, he can tune a piano, but can he? Well, never mind. Hope you enjoy.
There we go. So, this is a toughie. Who are you and where are you from? Oh, this is perfect. There you go. Welcome back.
Get a view of the, if you can see any of the snow in the background or not.
Yes. Wow. Most excellent.
And a lot of it's melted off the trees, but it's still, you know, I don't have a fire going yet in the little wood burning stove in my living room, but I have been on a nightly basis just because it's kind of a big room and keeping the furnace going is not inexpensive. So
I get that. So I think we just tried this. We'll go for it again. Who are you and where are you from?
Did I miss it? Did I get it wrong?
No, you just cut out. You locked up for as soon as I asked you your first question, the internet went hazy, but.
Oh,
we'll try it again.
Will Jennings, Conifer, Colorado. I'm not going to show you the snow again, though.
I already saw it.
You saw it. Yeah.
And so what do you do now, man?
Well, I'm still doing a few like little local tunings and stuff when I can. It's not, you know, I'm lucky to get one a month if I do that. But I'm rebuilding a 1916 baby grand piano that I've had for a billion years.
Holy moly.
And that's its own, not really a can of worms, more like a bucket of snakes, where everything I've taken off, it turns out I need to redo that. And the part I'm finding difficult is getting proper replacement screws and that for stuff that's either been too rusted or crusty or doesn't exist anymore. There was a mouse or two that lived in it and chewed up all the hammers and hammer shanks. So I was actually lucky and found a set of hammers and shanks for it on eBay for a 1920s Somer, but they fit really well. So
it was an upgrade.
Yeah. Well, yeah. From the chewed up 16. Yeah, I sent pictures of the guy that mentored me in tuning. I sent him pictures of the old hammers and with the caption, no matter how cute they are, never let a mouse reshape your hammers.
Exactly. So, hey, did you study the arts as a kid? Did you get any, I know that at this point, schooling, they don't have things like that in California or anything anymore. And
Unfortunately, I grew up in Colorado. So.
Yeah.
We had all kinds of stuff. I went to a very small elementary school, but they had, art and music teachers come in, you know, once or twice a week. And so there was always that. There was one teacher that came in and taught ancient languages. So Sanskrit, Greek, Latin, not that I remember much of it or any of it, but still, I mean, it's just to open up. And it's more as a, to understand where words come from, you know, it was more of an understanding. It wasn't, we weren't expected to learn Sanskrit, but it was just as a basis of how language developed. But I mean, that kind of stuff, just, I'm sure that, you know, language doesn't exist in schools anymore either, unless it's, you know, unless you're parroting politicians, pretty much.
A while back on NPR, I heard an article about a conversation with a guy who dealt with all of the dialects that used to exist within the United States and how they're disappearing at a very rapid rate. Everybody's starting to sound like everybody else.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not.
Huh. I guess that's right, but there's still, I mean, traveling around, people from Brooklyn still sound like they're from Brooklyn. So,
yeah,
some of the dialects are and stayed.
Yeah, and some of them don't go away. I'm sure that they're very firmly launched in the top five there. They wouldn't have it any other way. What was the first concert or live music event that you ever went to?
Well, I used to, my dad was a timpanist in the local symphony. So since I can remember, we used to go to symphony concerts when my dad was playing. But I mean, it was just a local, the Golden Symphony, the local town that I grew up in. As far as like a concert that I can, we used to go see the Denver Symphony play at Red Rocks. And then the first, I guess, not really a rock pop show that I saw that I can remember was in 1964, seeing Peter, Paul, and Mary at Red Rocks. They played every 4th of July at Red Rocks for, however that worked out. But anyway, so I, in 64, I did go and see them. And I saw, when I was in high school and stuff, saw a lot of pretty cool shows at Red Rocks.
I bet.
One of the shining ones on that one was a Soft Machine, Vanilla Fudge, and Jimi Hendrix in 69. Oh. So that was.
I approve. So at what point did you look at what we've got here and say that you really got to pursue this line of work? What was, did that come later?
Well, I was started off as a math major in college, and I played drums. My dad was played drums, like I said, a concert timpanist and that. And so since I was a kid, I played, like in the school bands and that kind of stuff. And then I started playing drums in college and, thought I was pretty good until I realized I sucked. And especially when I moved to LA thinking I was going to, be a rock star. And I was taking lessons from Joe Picaro and working at Leeds Rentals for, a number of years. And just watching people in LA playing and seeing all the guys that were, just head and shoulders above me and struggling to work. It's like, I don't know about this. And overhearing, at that rental place, we used to do a lot of cartridges for studio guys that did a lot of TV and movie dates. Mm-hmm. And so, we used to deliver stuff for Emil Richards and for Joe and that. And I just remember overhearing a conversation between, I think it might've been between Joe and Emil that, and they were saying, God, I don't know. And they were just sort of saying that they wouldn't know what to do if they were trying to start off in the business. And I said, the competition is too ridiculous. And, back when they started off, there was, two or three guys that good. And he goes, now there's two or three guys on every block that good. He goes, when I hear those guys saying, I don't know if I'd be able to make it at this point. It's like those guys. And said, I better rethink this. And plus every band I was in, I'd have my drums set up and then I'd be tuning the Rhodes or fixing the Mini Moog or, I realized that people would pay me to fix stuff and they wouldn't pay me to play. So I thought, I'm not that good. I'm never going to be that good, but people pay me to fix shit. So decided to do that instead. And then got into tuning pianos when I was, in the late mid-80s when I went back on the road and I was setting up pianos for bands and but not tuning. And you know, they'd get local tuners to come in from the PTG and stuff, and the every tuner complained about the last tuner, and the players complained about all of them. So I thought, well, I know it's not rocket surgery. And my roommate at the time was a Steinway trained piano tuner, and he's still currently the senior Steinway tech in Atlanta. Mm. So, and he lives, I don't know where does he live now? Athens, Georgia now, I think, but he has to go to Atlanta like once every 2 weeks and work on pianos for a week.
Hmm.
And because, you know, he's the Steinway guy out there. So anyway, you know, I'm still in touch with him quite a bit on that, but, yeah, I just, worked pretty tirelessly when I was in town. When I quit Leeds, they still had three rehearsal rooms and each room had a piano in it. And so I was able to go up there if nobody was in the room, you know, running, you know, doing rehearsals, and I could go in and work on pianos as long as I wanted. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, at first they said, well, no, we don't need that. I said, no, it's not going to cost you anything. And they go, yeah, come on up. I said, okay. So, you know, I was in a very fortunate circumstance in that I had access to, you know, any number of pianos, and Mike would just, you know, go up there with me on occasion. And so I just started doing that and ended up getting, you know, continually working on that skill, which is an unending process.
Mm-hmm. What year did you start at Leeds?
I started at Leeds in 80, maybe.
Yeah. Because you had just, I think when I first met you, you were either just back out on the road for the first time, or I got there in 85.
Well, I was still there. I think I left in 80. It was right when Andy sold it to Guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going through a number of personal things. I moved in with some disaster of a woman and had to get out of that situation. But and so, and at that point, it was just, you know, and the reason I worked at Leeds and got off the road to begin with was to try to be, you know, try to play and be in LA. And that's when it was a combination of realizing that's not going to happen. And I remember that the magazine, The Music Connection in LA. And, yep. And I'd look at those ads, you know, for drummers and no wanted, and too many, especially in the mid 80s was, you know, must have big kit, big hair, experience not necessary. It's like, wait a minute, why am I taking lessons from like one of the best guys on the planet and working really hard at playing well? And, you know, plus I was getting to the age where it wasn't going to happen. And working my way into the studio wasn't going to happen either as a studio percussionist or drummer, because that's just horribly locked up.
Yeah. Just the amount, I mean, not as much as the, you'd have to make any kind of a capital investment, though. Those guys used to carry a lot of stuff into those sessions. I remember clearly.
Yeah, it was, you know, the percussion rigs were just, it was ridiculous when you have five timpani and, you know, a gargantuan case full of every piece of hand percussion you can imagine and, you know, mallet instruments and, it just was endless.
Yeah. I love taking Paulinho in with six giant road trunks and he'd play a shaker for 15 minutes. And
yeah,
we'd still get the cartage.
At triple scale.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Well, and that was the deal is the players didn't pay for the cartage. It was all done through the production and through the contractor.
I remember it well.
And that's why they were able to take all that crap. I remember what was his name? Mark Stevens was not the piano player guy, but there was a percussionist named Mark Stevens that we used to haul his stuff around at Leeds. And he had one huge case that was basically a bar. And a lot of the reasons he got hired was because they wanted a bar at the session at 7 a.m. Like, yeah, okay. Who am I to judge?
That's right. Jim Cox used to have one too.
Oh, did he?
Oh, yeah. I think even with a sink.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I remember running into that. But also the fact it was very unusual for a keyboard player to have a 50-watt Marshall in their regular setup, but he did, so he could play those DX7 patches
right
at full tilt. Did you, I mean, you mentioned that you had a tuning mentor. Did you have anybody else that sort of led the way when you started out?
Yeah, there were a number of people that I knew in LA. And in fact, the two guys that I mostly learned from, one was Ed Kolakowski, who did a lot of touring with, in fact, with James Taylor and a lot of those people. And I never got any lessons from him particularly. He kept saying he was going to start like a sort of a tuning, not a school, but some sort of deal, which never happened. He did end up teaching one guy, I think, who still does some tunings in LA. But similar to what I, you know, when I overheard these guys talking about, you know, starting off as a percussionist in town, Mike, the guy who mostly taught me, and Ed were like two of the best in LA, and they couldn't break into the studios because that was just locked up by Keith and a guy named Warren, I believe. Mm-hmm. And they still had it locked up. I mean, up until I left.
Yeah.
And Keith actually handed off his business to his son. He rode his bike around, you know, Hollywood and tuned pretty much every piano and, you know, at all the studios. And the thing is he would tune, I mean, 10 or 15 a day.
So right. He was
making just stupid amounts of money. But the only way he did that was by not tuning the pianos to 440. He tuned them to themselves. And there was one session I got called in late to at some studio up in North Hollywood. And a friend of mine was, you know, pretending to produce this some band, but they went in with existing tracks and they wanted to overdub a piano. So I went down and sat down at the piano. And as soon as I hit the A, I went up to the owner of the studio manager. And I think he was the owner. And I said, is Keith your usual tuner? He goes, yeah, why? I said, the piano's nowhere near 440. He's going, he just tuned it yesterday. I said, it doesn't matter. I said, Keith just doesn't tune to 440. He tunes it to himself. That's why tunes it to itself. And that's why he was able to do 10 or 15 a day, going and spend 15 minutes instead of an hour.
Right.
And and he was a good tuner. I mean, he did it right other than, you know, actually tuning it to 440.
Yeah.
And so the one guy that was like the sort of the other producer guy for this thing was like, I said, well, here, and they only gave me a half an hour to tune. And I said, here's the deal. The piano will not be at 440. The guy goes, why aren't you any good? I said, I'm fine. Said the piano is so far out that it won't get to 440 without sounding sproingy. And so what I'm going to have to do is tune it the way Keith tunes it to itself, you know, put in the unison, make sure everything is in tune in that respect. And then you have to VSO the tracks. So that's the only choice you've got because unless you give me an hour and a half, we don't have that much time. I said, well, okay, you don't. So
tuning has its own special issues. The front of house guy that I work with right now actually plays, I believe it's the Boxer, the original version of the Boxer by S&G. And that is so very speeded that if I'm working on a guitar and tuning it, it makes me crazy because it's nowhere near 440. The recording is really? Because they just sped it up to make it seem more exciting or something.
Right.
But it's not. I mean, there's a few recordings that came out of the 60s that were not even close.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then when I started tuning for Guns N' Roses in, 91? Mm-hmm. And I actually, it was the end of 90 or early, or very early 91, before they even went into rehearsals, I had to work on Axl's piano and Dizzy's because they were both a half step flat. So they were a B-flat 440 instead of A 440. And what was funny is when, you know, friends of mine would come in that played piano, they'd sit down and play Axl's piano and then freak him out. He couldn't play it.
Right.
Because like, what's going on here? And then the best one out of that, one of my favorite ones was we did the MTV Awards. Was that 91? With they did November Rain, but they brought in two pianos, and Axl was playing one and Elton was playing the other. So Elton's guy comes up to me, you know, during rehearsal. He goes, Elton has a question for you. I said, okay. So he goes, Axel's piano is tuned down a half step. I said, yeah, it's at B flat 440. He's going, what key is he playing in? I said, oh, he'll be playing in C and you'll be playing in B. He goes, oh, that would be fine. He goes, I was just afraid he was playing in G and I'd be playing in F sharp. I said, nah, you're good. You're playing in B. You'll be good.
Yeah, I've actually, you know, with the Indigo Girls, we've been doing a lot of symphony dates, and I'm sitting over there with all my flashy wheelie strobe tuners and everything, and sometimes I even remember to ask the people that are in charge of the orchestra at where they actually, you know, tune themselves. Usually I find the harpist is usually near pretty close to me, and they've always got a tuner. They're always coming in and tuning before everybody else. And I got to a point where I could get all of the tuners on the pedals, on the pedal boards and mine, and get them all in the right place so that it didn't turn into a catastrophe. Most of the time, unless they have a piano on the gig, they stay around 440.
Well, I've tuned before a couple of times for Stevie Wonder, and for a while, everybody was at 440 except his piano was at 442. Mm-hmm. And so, God, wasn't that out of whack? I said, no, it's actually, you can't tell other than the piano just stands out a little bit. And he couldn't even, you know, and you'll notice it sounds a little, but it just sounds a little brighter. It doesn't sound out of tune. You'd have to play two notes, you know, side by side to even hear it. And, you know, and just sit there and, you know, hold them both down and go, oh, okay, that's, you're hearing beats. But playing a song, it just makes the piano, you know, kind of jump out a little bit more.
Let's see. What are your thoughts about, this is a couple of backline questions. What are your thoughts about musical texts versus technical texts? I mean, we all know that you get people who have a music background, and then there seems to be these people that kind of got into the business and took it up as a trade or a craft. And, you know, I really became surprised running into some people who didn't really know how to play. And yet they were really good at their jobs.
Well, I don't play piano. And so I think in some cases, musical background is kind of helpful. I've seen it be as much of a detriment as anything else, too. When, you know, when I hear, oh, man, yeah, I get to sit up and then I have time to practice. And it's like, well, no. And I actually lost a gig. You know, I was up for, I think it was the Stones, and had to go meet with Pierre and all that. And Peter Wiltz was the other guy that was up for the gig. And so I didn't, you know, we were both kind of giving each other a hard time. Oh, that's my next gig. No, that's my next gig and all that. But, you know, it was a friendly competition. And Pete got the gig because he was really into like roadie bands and did that schmooze thing. And Pierre was really into that. And I didn't even bring it up to Pierre because I think roadie bands are the stupidest thing in the world. And I hate when somebody said, oh yeah, man, we're going to play this song. I said, no, actually we don't. You know, it's like, I'm sorry. You know, that's not what I'm here for. I quit playing music for a reason. And I'm continuing to not play for a reason, you know, and if I have, like, you know, I got a keyboard sitting around at home or stuff like that, that's fine. But, you know, wasting my time with a bunch of other road guys that can't play is just sad. And so I think, like I said, it can be helpful there are people that that play. There's one guitar tech who's a really good guitar player, and he's actually good enough to where he doesn't play, you know, unless asked. And he'll actually jam with the band when they come in before the guitar, and because he's good enough to actually do that. You know, when I was with Ringo, he was Luke's guitar tech, and he's a really accomplished guitar player, and but doesn't sit there and noodle all day like, you know, like too many guys who think they can play do and actually can't. So it's there's some technical guys. It depends. I mean, there's some that are really good. There's a lot of them that I think, especially in the realm of keyboard techs, most of them are now not keyboard techs at all, but playback guys. You know, they're great at running Digital Performer and or Ableton or one of those things, but they don't know crap about keyboards. Mm-hmm. They don't know anything about wiring. They can't solder to save their lives. You know, anything. They can't do anything technical in that respect. They can program, and some of them can't even program the keyboards, but they claim to be keyboard techs. So that hits a weird spot too. And the biggest problem is there's calls that I've gotten to be a keyboard tech. And when they tell me the situation, I say, you don't want a keyboard tech. You want a playback guy. And unfortunately for a lot of manufacturers, they're all called Pro Tools guys when rarely do they use Pro Tools.
Yeah. Well, Kleenex, Q-tip, Frigidaire, yeah. They all,
Xerox.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating. I mean, I've had a couple people on so far here at Bitterman Circle, and to find out. I mean, I was I had a great conversation with Terry Lawless about his playing career and his teching career, and it's kind of he was part of the reason why I, in talking about the band that he used to work for or still works for, I guess, there's a delicate line between collaboration and support. You know, is there a danger in influencing the musician, sharing inappropriate information? You know, I mean, you get to that point where you're like, well, hey, why don't you try this? Or, this is the way somebody else did this, and I know there's a few techs that are like that. And
I try to steer clear of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody asks me hey, I'm thinking of replacing this keyboard or I'm thinking of doing this, I'll give them an opinion if I'm asked. But, I'm done trying to impress anybody. Maybe in my youth, I'm sure I was as boisterous and goofy as every other jerkwad that has been in this business. But last couple of decades, I've tried to curtail that and just go and do my job. Shut up. When I did the Groban gig a couple of years ago, they brought in this system of, and it was all designed by some, we used to joke that it was somebody who lives in his mom's basement and doesn't really know how to build anything. Mm-hmm. Because the way it was put together and the way it was wired looked like the type of stuff I did when I was 15, where it was really just super tight and just, and I thought that was the way to do it when you realize, well, okay, that's not the way to do it, because if something goes wrong, you can't even try to troubleshoot anything one by one. You have to unplug everything because it's so tightly bound together. In fact, they had quarter inch outputs where it was so tight, they didn't even put the sleeves on the quarter inch on the quarter inch ends. They left those off so it could be even tighter. It's like, and the production manager found these guys. I go, whose mom's basement did you find these guys in? I said, look, you might think they're really good, but they are not. And then, something went wrong with one of the systems. And the guy's like, Mr. Know-it-all of of this and, oh, it's this and, oh, here we, it's like, well, you know, and our, the playback guy was saying, well, you know, I'm using digital. Oh, nobody uses Digital Performer anymore. He goes, well, except for, you know, names off, you know, basically every top act. Mm-hmm. And this guy's talking about some like weeny little Canadian band that uses Ableton. It's like, that's great, except, you know, if you don't make your systems a little more versatile. But anyway, so it just, that was the last time I ran into anything where I had a suggestion of this is not the way to do it. And just the way they had it running was, it just was far more difficult than it had to be. And instead of, you know, you want as few points of failure as you can possibly get. And they added probably 6 points of failure to every aspect of it. So that this ran this and that ran that. Oh, and this can run this. And oh, this can do this and this can do this. Like, so what? Basically, what you want is for the guy to sit down and play and it plays instead of, you know, oh, this triggers this, this does this, that goes to that, that goes through that, that has to go through this, that goes through that, that does this, and it ends up over here. You know, you end up with a Rube Goldberg keyboard rig. And,
yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, when these things go wrong, it's got to be, you know, you got to be able to get it out of in a hurry, you know, and that's what I was thinking. I mean, why should the first piece of gear that you go for be a pair of wire nippers so you could actually do something?
Yeah. You know?
But, yeah, I know you don't really go down that audiophile rabbit hole all that much yourself, but, what do you think about, I mean, that we are living in a time with a whole generation who has only heard MP3s.
Yeah.
Never heard. I mean, perhaps when they actually go to a show and hear people play a live performance, they could hear something or get to a piece of vinyl. But I mean, do you think we've kind of lost a whole generation of people as far as them being aware of what the stuff sounds like?
Oh yeah. And the funny thing is when you mention MP3 is that MP3 was originated to be able to when modems and that kind of stuff first came into play, was to have a very compressed audio file that could be sent to somebody to exchange ideas. It was never meant to be the recording. Mm-hmm. You know, it was never meant to be that's the final thing. And I remember running into that situation when I used to do the wiring for a composer in LA, and he did, you know, 175 major motion pictures. I mean, he was a real deal guy, and he, you know, he was really ticked. He ended up with a system that, and he'd do stuff on Digital Performer, and then had Digital Performer play all the synths and instruments and stuff. And so he was really ticked. I went in there one time and he was just fuming because the producers had come in, you know, producers of the movie, and he plays them, you know, what he had written for the stuff. And they go, God, that's it. And he's going, okay, when do we go into the studio? Because it was like, to him, you go into the studio with an orchestra and you actually do it. And they go, no, that's it. He goes, no, it isn't. This is, this is garbage. This is just, no, that's perfect. No, it isn't. And he was just flabbergasted that they would basically settle for that. And that's kind of the same thing. And, but even the last time when I said, about a year ago, I guess covered Bill Sainamore on a few of shows for Steely Dan, and they had, ice is falling off the roof. They had gotten rid of the Steinway and were using a Nord piano for the piano sound. And it's like, I just was shaking my head. It's like, okay, if you're going to go electronic, why go with a Nord? And I'll constantly make fun of the, you know, it's like, yeah, when you think great piano sounds, you always think Sweden. But they went with it, and you know, Fagan is just Mr. Tuning. You know, it's got to be. And the thing is, the problem with any electric piano or electronic piano thing is they're purposely out of tune, and they're excuses for authenticity. So the unisons have beats and wows in them and all this crap that you can't do anything about. And that's because most of the time, most local tuners from the PTG aren't their best guys or their students or their, you know, and it takes them 5 hours to get a very, very mediocre tuning. And so they just sort of, you know, it turns into a compromise. And when I was doing those things, I was telling Donald, I go, man, I say, there's only so much you can do. I said, these things are out of tune, period. There's nothing you can do about it. He's going, yeah. I said, now, the biggest problem for me is that it's just so off and just such a compromise. But the other big problem is that 99% of the audience will never know the difference. And, you know, especially, you know, I've had really good pianos that people mic horribly. You know, they'll use a Helpensteel or those. I'd probably get in trouble for this, but I don't care because they know I don't like them. But those Earthworks piano mic systems are unbelievably horrible. And there are so many guys that use them. And I remember we did a residency last year with James in Vegas, and the house sound guy was, oh God, these things are a godsend. These things are great. I said, no, they're terrible. Well, what do you mean? I said, they're fast. They set up quickly. I said, but they sound awful. I said, they're not transparent at all. And well, Dave is a big fan of those, Dave Morgan. And he goes, oh, well, you have to do this and you have to do this. And he does a lot of work to make them sound as good as they can. I said, it still sounds like crap. Said, the thing is, it doesn't, oh, but it's a great piano sound. I go, but it's not that piano. That doesn't sound like that piano. That piano sounds like this if you turn off the mics and you have it, you know, as good as it can get through those crap, you know, mics, you know, crap mics that cost $3,000. And, but they just, to them, it's easy to set up and that's why they go with it. And I've worked with other guys that refuse to use them and use like real mics. And it's like, there's a world of difference. I go, it's, you know, it's so nice to hear a piano that sounds like the piano that I'm working on versus, you know, I'm working on this piano and the sound that's coming out is who knows what.
Well, right. I mean, this is another part of what I was talking about. It's the idea of, you know, transparency. I mean, it's really a big part of, one of the people I talked to said, you know, invisibility is a real big part of our job. And, yeah. and that, I mean, in actual form and in function, I think that that's true. I mean, and it goes back to what we were talking about before about having a system, which is very simple. You know, you basically get from point A to point B. And it shouldn't be a mystery how it works, because something's going to go wrong, and it's going to go wrong in a big way. You know, you want to be able to take care of it. I had one person who actually makes guitar systems, and he had this little black box where the signal would go out of the wah-wah pedal and then into the main pedal board, and the wah-wah pedal broke during the show. And so I went out there. I had maybe 30 seconds while the artist was doing a costume change or something like that.
Right.
And I, you know, went over, I pulled the cables out to put the other wah-wah pedal in and plugged them in, and it didn't work. And I find out when I ended up talking to the guy who built the system is that you cannot unplug from this black box until you've turned off the power or it'll blow up. And there was no, I mean, I was going, well, this just makes it a very inconvenient thing to have on the road.
What was the point of that?
I think it was just for the blowing up part. I think that's why it was there. I don't know what it was. If it was a buffered input or something like that, it would be, it wouldn't do that. But for some reason,
the only way I could see that being viable was if when it blew up, a little mushroom cloud came out. That would be worth watching.
Absolutely, I would have sent.
I don't get it.
What would you say your proudest moment is? I mean, this can be personal or professional. You've traveled a bit. You've done a few large gatherings. Didn't know if any of them you held a special place in your heart.
Not really. I mean, a lot of moments that stand out, but not one in particular over the other. It's kind of like, you know, it gets to a certain level and they're all, you know, pretty memorable things. Some of them goofy, some of them fun, you know, it's just, and I think being a part of a lot of these shows and regardless of the size of the show, I mean, I've been just as excited over, you know, a show that in front of 1,000 people as I have been in front of 100,000 people. And, there's some bands that are just, you know, when I was working for Little Feet, I mean, just every night was just a joy, you know, especially working for Richie Hayward. But, mm-hmm. and actually, in that, we were doing some shows with the Grateful Dead. And it was up in Northern California, I'm sure, someplace. But this is one of the many standout moments, but this one's particularly cool. That's that, you know, I'd sit behind Richie and give him tempos and stuff. And standing behind me was Jerry Garcia and Bill Graham. So I go, oh, okay. So Richie breaks a pair of sticks. So I go over and toss him the trash can. Bill Graham goes over and gets the sticks out of the trash can. So I go, I can get you a pair of sticks of his. He goes, no, I watched him break these. And Jerry's just like, and Bill said, it's like, he's our favorite drummer in the world. And Jerry's just, yeah, this guy's amazing. I go, he is that. Mm-hmm. And so after the show, you know, they took off and Jerry had to get ready and Bill had other stuff to do. So they get done and we tear down and stuff. And I saw Richie afterwards and I said, you know, Bill and Jerry were standing behind me the whole show. He's going, who? You know, Bill Graham, Jerry Garcia. And he goes, why? He goes, Bill told me, he's like, you are their favorite drummer on the planet. Humble Richie was. And he was just like, no, that can't be right. I go, hey, they said it. So, and it was just, you know, and Richie was so special anyway that, you know, and when you tell him stuff like that, he just got really, ooh, gee, no, that can't be right. Not me. You know, he was such a sweet cat. Well, that was a tremendous loss.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Jerry Manuel was another person who's done a Bitterman Circle with us. And it's the same. Everybody's saying the same thing about Little Feet as being perhaps, if not the best band I've ever, I mean, I best one I've ever toured with. I mean, as a unit. And that, I mean, that definitely was a part of who Richie was, you know. I mean, he was part of this thing. And it was funny because a lot of people, I used to put this one theory up in the air. I said, Richie had a tendency to rush a little bit. Yeah. And Sam used to take issue with it. And he would try to play behind the beat to kind of drag him back. And Kenny would just sort of sit there and play right in the middle. Mm-hmm. So it was this wonderful flam that went through. I mean, everybody was like, oh, it's very New Orleans-like, you know? And I'm like going, well, yeah. But it's actually, it's a problem that was being trying, people were trying to correct. I mean, I guess in the early days, Lowell was pretty stern with him when it came to tempo. many stories I heard where, you know, he was, you know, he was rushing again, and Lynn Lowell was not one to suffer that kind of stuff, you know.
Right. Well, and the reason Richie came up with the style of playing that he does is that Lowell would never, ever allow a drum solo.
Well, yeah.
And so Richie developed a style where pretty much every song was a drum solo. And the funny thing was, is when I was playing drums, and long before I met, you know, Richie and stuff, I'd listen to Little Feet records and try to play some of that stuff. And it's like, it didn't make any sense, because the only place that those licks fit were in that song.
Right.
So unless I was playing that song, there was no reason to learn what he was playing. Mm-hmm. But it was just, even trying to play that stuff was just, you know, between the mental and physical part of it, it was impossible. Another one of those stories was, we're doing a show in Colorado Springs, and my dad and mom came down, and my dad was standing over by me, over by, off stage left, and I can't remember which song it was, but it was a song that Richie started off with, this just, you know, Richie Hayward type groove. And so I go, okay, Dad, watch this beginning of this song, this intro, and tell me how it's done. So I was watching my dad watching Richie, and I can see my dad like kind of. And finally, he turns to me, he goes, oh, that's easy. That can't be done. I go, okay, right. Good. That's all I need to hear.
Yeah, it was amazing. He was amazing. He was just an amazing player and an amazing person.
Yeah.
And went way too soon.
Yeah. Well, I was glad to hear about Paul, too. That was last year, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, it was. It had gone on, was going on for a while, you know. And like a lot of people who have cancer, you know, he was, he kind of had these peaks and valleys, you know, and it kind of looked at like that for a while there. It looked like it was going to be okay. And then he just got sick, and that was it.
You know?
I was thinking about that guy, the guy who was in that Black Panther movie who just passed away.
Right.
I mean, he had this cancer for 4 years. So, I mean, throughout all of that movie making that he was a part of, he was sick as a dog, you know. I mean,
well, and that's grueling stuff too.
Yeah, it's a very physical role, I believe. Yeah.
Well, that, and just, I mean, making a movie is grueling. Even, you know, the sitting around part is even worse, because you're waiting for some goofball to make a decision, or the, you know, the continuity guy isn't quite sure if that magazine was at this, on this page or on this page, and you're sitting there forever while they go back through trailer, or, you know, go back through dailies and see, you know, okay, that's right, but now this light isn't right, you know, and just
they did a television. I was working for a band that had a rehearsal room backstage, and this television program, a series, came in to do a scene in our little world, and I used to set up pipe and drape everywhere and kind of give them the same footprint every night so that they kind of would be comfortable. So all of a sudden, we're going to do this same thing, but we're going to add another 35 people in the room. And so I sort of pushed the pipe and drape up in one direction, and I just sat there and thought about it. This scene that basically goes on between the singer and the main character of the show. And I said, you know, right behind this piece of cloth they're standing up against is another 50 people all standing there, you know, being bored.
Right.
And, it's a film and television. That stuff is just great. I'm glad I actually didn't do too much. I mean, I did cartage in my day, but I'm glad I never had to really do much of that.
Yeah. There was a time when, a couple of friends of mine, actually, that I'd worked with at Leeds, had gotten into being A1s, A2s. And, you know, they were saying, oh, man, you should get it. This is like, it's, you know, cake gig. It's easy, you know, it's great. So I'd, applied, and they said, "Oh, you don't." And that we had, I had just gotten done, I think, with a tour where we'd done a lot of TV shows and a lot of, you know, a lot of that type of stuff. And they said, "Well, you don't have any broadcast experience." I go, "We just did, you know, this and this and this and this and blah, blah, blah." And I said, "You know what? I give up." And so I called my buddy Randy. I said, "You know what? They're just, it's not, well, let me, you know," and he even gave me, you know, sort of a backdoor way and people to talk to and stuff. And I go, "You know what? It's just not worth it." So
yeah,
that's fine.
So
I'm glad to not be in LA anyway. So
yeah, I'm with you on that one. That's for sure. So what does it take? I mean, how, what kind of person does it take to actually go on the road and maybe not just even survive, but actually thrive to a certain extent? I mean, I've known you for a good while now, and I think that you've been trying to get off the road for almost all of that time.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, mm-hmm. There's aspects of the road that just fit my personality really well. And you know, my parents would tell me when I were little kids, you know, I mean, when I was barely able to walk, I was, you know, constantly running away, you know, finding a way out of the backyard. And they said they'd see, you know, my brother and my sister in the backyard and my diaper. And I'd be out like running around naked in town. And they said it was a constant thing. And then when I first started doing this, my dad would come to shows. He goes, "You know what? You have found the perfect job for yourself." And a lot of that was, I just loved, getting paid to travel was great. The whole business of touring has changed radically since, you know, we started, in that it used to be, it was basically support for album sales. And so it was, you know, it was a lot more fun for everybody. When album sales ceased to exist and it became the source of income for bands, then everything changed, you know, where it was much, much more management oriented. And the bands had, there are a few bands that will still, you know, apparently, you know, stand up for their crew and they want it to be at least an enjoyable experience. But for the most part, the artist has no idea, you know, and, you know, a lot of it is, yeah, I was been living on a bus for decades, and it's, that's gotten old. But a lot of it, like I said, and the people coming into the bus aren't, it's just not, I don't know, it's not the same thing. There's the enthusiasm is not for, you know, being part of the whole musical experience, you know. And that's why I was, you know, there's those of us that were just enjoyed being a part of that, you know, knowing that we were, you know, no, we aren't playing, but we're facilitating somebody who can. And that was a lot of it. And there are still people that do that are really into the whole aspect of that. But the, you know, even tours that should be just a breeze because of management and that are not. And they become, you know, goofy and, you know, I mean, dumb stuff like, you know, why did you buy this? I said, well, because, you know, I bought a $50, you know, one hydraulic or a pneumatic thing for a chair because it kept, you know, during the show, the piano player would be playing and the chair would just pop down. It's like, well, that's no good. So I found, you know, I got a hold of the company that sold him where he got the chair and, you know, figured out the length of the tube it had to be and all this and had it shipped. And the thing was, they called back during sound check on a Friday. So I didn't have time to run away, go to the production office, get it okay, go through all that. So I just ordered it. And the production manager was just fuming that I didn't go, "You have to go through us." I go, "Look, here's the situation. It's $50. I said, "If you have a big problem with that, I'll buy it. I'll pay for it. Okay, if it's that huge a deal, well, it's just, we have a way to do things. I go, wrong a lot of times, but okay. Mm-hmm. Said, my job is to make sure, you know, the show must go on. And
right.
My job is to facilitate that happening. And $50 is not going to break this show. Trust me. You know, when they're guaranteed, what, $500,000 a night or something, I don't think the $50 is going to kill them. But, just that kind of stuff where people get this, the people that have become production managers aren't production managers anymore. A lot, and in a lot of cases, they are
right. Minions
of management. And, I've seen it in a couple of cases where production managers are not even present. You know, they're phoning in their part, as it were, and they have somebody. And so anytime, you can't go to the production office and ask a question, it turns into a conference call every time. And so it's just not even worth, you know, not even worth trying to find out anything or trying to get anything done, because, like, you know, it's not going to happen.
Right.
And then there's, you know, the usual, I'm sure you've run into the people that are, oh, well, we pay half for rehearsals and that kind of stuff. It's like, no, you know, that's when all the work is being done, for one thing. And God, there was one where the tour was like 9 weeks long and it was 10 weeks of rehearsals in New York, and they wanted to pay half. It's like, so over mm-hmm. half the time is at half pay in New York.
Which is 50% tax line right there. Yeah. When I worked for Paul Simon, it was the same thing. We do rehearsals in New York and they'd pay us and withhold from us. And it just, I mean, it was crazy. It was 50 or 51% was taken out of our paychecks at 50% of what we were supposed to be getting.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And again, a lot of that is all happening with either, you know, production guys who are minions of management or go to management and say, oh, look what I can do. And they, you know, it pads their bonus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's a number of reasons when I, you know, keep saying I'm getting out of the business. It's like, it's all that buildup of stuff that's been happening where it isn't the same. And like I said, this is a great year for this to happen, actually, because, okay.
Yep. This is, and you've walked us right into our last question here, which is, what in the hell just happened to our careers? I mean, where did our business go? I mean, it is amazing. I never thought it was going to be the audience that would cause us not to be able to work, but it is, you know. Yeah. By accident, I found out that I think I'm actually doing a gig on October 23rd, which, did you go somewhere? Did I go somewhere?
Something happened. I lost the video.
Okay.
Am I on?
You're good. You're recording okay. Well. Yeah, right. We're okay.
Well, it's funny because I was talking to some neighbors and, they had, Jimmy Buffett had scheduled a show for Red Rocks this month, actually. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh yeah, we had tickets to that, but they obviously postponed it to next year. But, and they were saying, it's like, I'm not going unless there's a proven vaccine. And the whole, thing. I mean, there's just a massive amount of fear mongering basically that's been going on with you know, this whole COVID thing. And I it's, you know, the fact that they don't know, but the fact that they're just overblowing everything, trying to you know, keep it in check, but also just all the estimates and stuff were way overblown.
Right.
The morbidity rate was way overblown. I'm going to try to load it again. Hey, there it is. And a lot of stuff is wrong. And you can look at countries that didn't shut down. And I know I talked to a couple of people that, you know, I was saying, well, the thing to do for acts that can do it would be, I mean, like James would be able to pull it off, would be to start off with a residency. Because the other thing is, I don't know if you got the, I got an email from their production, from the Event Safety Alliance. I don't know if you saw that. And basically, it's a 30-page thing. I haven't made it past page 15 because I'm laughing too hard. And, you know, this whole thing, oh, well, you have to have a safety team to help you set up. It's like, okay, the people helping you set up the piano have to be 6 feet apart. Well, the piano is only 7.5 feet long. And I need about, you know, 10 people around it to lift it up on the riser. Mm-hmm. So how is that going to work? And just looking at it and then also thinking that the people that will be, whoever would be assigned to be the safety monitors or whoever would basically have the same training as a TSA agent, you know, and as much knowledge. And, you know, pointing some like thermal thing at your forehead. Well, after you've been out in the sun, yeah, of course, your surface temperatures, you know, they're just not going to have a clue what they're looking at. And all of a sudden, everything going to a screeching halt because some clown in a with a badge says you have to stop. And just looking at it and how it was, how they expected to be set up is an average setup, you know, 5-6 hours, 8 hours, whatever it be, would take 3 days. Mm-hmm. And teardown would be just as bad. And then how do you unload or load a truck when everybody has to be 6 feet apart? That doesn't work.
Yeah.
And nobody is, I don't know who they had piping in on this alliance, but they've never done a show. Or if they have, it's been from an armchair.
Well, it's interesting because the Metallica camp just did a few weeks of rehearsals and then filmed this concert up in Sonoma somewhere, and that was presented at drive-ins all over the country on August 29th, I think it was.
Right.
And they actually had a COVID compliance officer who was overseeing all of the testing that was going. These guys were getting tested every couple of days. I think the band, I'm not sure if the band was doing it every day, but these guys were basically leaving their hotel room and with a mask on, and they were that way until they got back to the room, and they weren't going anywhere. You know, they were,
right.
They were quarantined. And I could see where, and this is part of the conversation that I find interesting. I think that with a lot of these larger events, it's going to be a long time before we see them. But I think for smaller groups that are doing large clubs, small theaters, they're going to have a better chance of, you know, going out and doing this successfully because of the amount of numbers of people in every area is going to be lower.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can't sit there and take a group that's going to have 1,000 people in the audience and only put 500 in there, because there's no financial way that it makes sense for the promoter, the artist, the manager, the agent, or the crew.
Yeah. You know,
it's really kind of very tricky. But like I said, I just saw in Rolling Stone, it looks like the Indigo Girls are doing this Live Nation drive-in event at the end of October. They're doing 4 shows with different headliners for each show, but it's very much an obviously sort of a smaller footprint it might be able to do. But you know what I found that was really interesting? I'm not sure if you know him. You probably do, but the compliance officer for the Metallica gig was Butch Allen.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So he was the one who was telling all the crew guys what they needed to do, which
that's interesting.
I found it fascinating.
Well, the reason I was talking about doing a residency is because, first of all, if things are allowed to get back up and running, you're not competing for buses. You're not competing for trucks. Right. You're not having to worry about setup and teardown on a daily basis. You set up once. Well, okay, if it takes 3 days to set it up, but if you're there, going to be there for 5 weeks, well, or 3 weeks, right, or 5 weeks, whatever the residency could support, but you wouldn't be dealing with, you know, having to have that many people. You would have to deal with, you know, if people would be willing to come in or fly to Vegas. And I think the other part that I thought was that Vegas is so dead that they'd be, you know, who knows what incentives they would offer, yeah, to get them going like that. But even then, it's, I don't see that happening in a year. James has dates on his website. Basically, the tours that we were supposed to do this year have been rebooked for next year, which is a smart move because that way the venues are booked, or at least the venues are on hold, and everything's in place for that if it's allowed to happen.
And so they didn't have to get the money back.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in on those conversations, fortunately.
I'm saying for the audience. I mean, the audience, yeah. So they say, here, your tickets are good for next year on this date.
Oh, right.
So, I mean, I'm sure people did go for refunds, but, you know, who in our business gives away money?
Well, yeah. Yes, it is the music business, not the music giveaway.
Exactly. Will, you are an absolute, well, you are one of the founders of Bitterman Circle, so it's great to have you on the podcast.
I love in that one, God, where was that? It was outside of Santa Barbara in that bar when I sent you those pictures of the Bitterman Bitters.
Oh, yeah.
it's excellent. Classic.
Yeah. And they've got something for everybody. Well, maybe. I mean, I keep seeing places that have familiar names on them, and they've got nothing to do with the people that I know. But I really appreciate you making the time for us. And
no worries. It looks like I got plenty of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like Chopper said, he says, no, he says, don't worry, I'm right on time, you know. Anyhow. It's good to see you, brother. Hang in there, and I hope the winter is not too brutal this year.
If it is, it's fine.
It could be 80 tomorrow anyways, you know.
Well, yeah, it is Colorado. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes.
Exactly. All right, pal.
Very good.
Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Take care.